I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact, among others. The Children's Television Workshop, now called the Sesame Workshop, started the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in 2007 to study the effects of digital technology on childhood literacy. Joan was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1990, and she's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you remember your first introduction to the alphabet or numbers?
Well, I do, as a matter of fact. I did not go to kindergarten, but I started first grade before I was six. And I don't think I'd been taught the alphabet because I remember it being on cards around the room, and I got it right away. I was so ready for school, having not gone to kindergarten, that I started reading pretty quickly and knowing the alphabet.
How come you didn't go to kindergarten?
My mother didn't want me to leave home. I was the last of her three children, and so she had made me stay at home. So here I was raring to go by the time I got to first grade at five.
Do you remember, was there a book popular or part of the cultural zeitgeist that you can recall when you were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old? Like, what was your Sesame Street?
I don't remember the children's books that I was read because... For one thing, the books that were being read were probably aimed slightly higher than my age because my three of us were born in 3 years and 3 months, and I was the youngest. So I think probably most of the story books were aimed a little higher. I don't remember the books I was read until I started reading, when it was the Bobbsey Twins and the Little Colonel and those children's series. But I started reading chapter books right away. I did not spend much time on picture books, but I remember Dick and Jane, which was the first reading book in first grade. I remember it very well.
What did your parents do?
My mother was a stay-at-home mom, and my father was a banker. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in a very traditional kind of home.
This was in the 1930s.
1930s and 40s in Arizona.
Do you remember your first interaction with television, your early interactions with television?
There was the Adlai Stevenson-Dwight Eisenhower campaign of 1951, maybe, or 52. And I watched Adlai Stevenson's acceptance speech at the convention. That was the first thing I remember. And then it was two or three years later that the Army-McCarthy hearings came on and changed history, and I watched some of that. I didn't have a TV set, so I was dependent on the kindness of neighbors to see television.
You were in New York City in your 20s. What made you come to New York?
I had known, I don't know, from the time I was the littlest child that I would not live in Phoenix. And I went to the University of Arizona for college. And all during that period, my best friends were people that wanted to leave Phoenix and do something. And one of them, I went to Washington. So I joined her and her family in Washington after I graduated and worked for the federal government in the State Department. And then I went back to Phoenix and worked on a newspaper until I saved enough money to move to New York. But that was almost always the goal.
What did you do when you came to New York?
I tried to get a job at the New York Times and was eventually offered one on the women's page, naturally, and that was easy for me to turn down. What I had in mind was being an intrepid reporter on stories. And I had been on the women's page of the Arizona Republic, but they had given me lots of broader assignments than writing about weddings and tea parties and that sort of thing. And I knew the women's page at the Times would be restricted to weddings, and that was not for me. And I went into the press and public information department of RCA, which owned NBC. And as soon as I could, I transferred down to NBC and did publicized their soap operas and other kinds of programs that they had,
And what was your personal life like at the time?
I lived with a girl I had grown up with in Phoenix, and she was an actress and in Hollywood most of the time. So I had her apartment, and she knew everybody in New York for a variety of reasons. Her family was in Phoenix very prominent, so they met every Easterner that came out, every famous Easterner. So she knew, she had a very wide circle of prominent friends, and she very generously shared all these people with me. So I was in a life that wasn't, that was very starry, and that part was fun, but I was, felt not up. I mean, here I was with no achievement at all, and I was with people who were directors of television plays and director of Broadway plays and heads of production companies and all of that. And here was little me, was how I felt. But eventually I left RCA and went to NBC and then left NBC because I couldn't make enough money to live, mm-hmm. practically, and went to work for the U.S. Steel Corporation to publicize their play that was on every 2 weeks on television called The U.S. Steel Hour.
What was that about, The U.S. Steel Hour?
It was a drama every 2 weeks. It alternated with someone else's, another corporation's drama. But ours was produced by the Theater Guild, which was a very prominent production, Broadway production company in New York. And so I learned a lot about theater, about casting. It was in the bad old days when we had there was a list of people you couldn't cast in, or whose names, whose plays you could not accept because they were said to have red ties.
Communist ties.
Yeah. So it was an interesting period that you had to clear, that we had to clear all names with the advertising agency.
How did you develop an interest in entertainment and in journalism? Your dad was a banker. Your mom was a housewife from Arizona. How did you fall into that world?
Well, I took acting and acted in the plays, school plays and little theater when I was in high school. So I always had an interest in being an actress. But my father said, if you are an actress, you will never receive a penny of support from me. Thank God he said that, because I had the interest, but I was much better behind the scenes, behind the camera, as it were. And I majored in education and came out certified to teach in Arizona, which I had no intention of doing. But in those days, mothers said to their daughters, in case your husband dies, you'll have a job that will give you the same hours as your children and the vacation time when your children have vacation time. So all the little girls of my generation, or many, majored in education. But I never was going to spend my life with children and women. I mean, at that time, I wanted to be where the action was, and that's where journalism and television and so on.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. The Sesame Workshop created Sesame Street in 1969. The germ of Children's Television Workshop started at a dinner party that you had at your home with your husband, then Tim Cooney.
That's correct.
At the time. How did that happen?
Tim and I were friends of Lloyd Morissette and Mary Morissette. Lloyd was vice president of Carnegie Corporation, the big foundation. And we were very close to my boss at Channel 13, who was a very theatrical, dramatic, and brilliant man. So he was there at the dinner party, plus someone I worked with named Anne Bement. So it was six of us. And Lewis, this very dramatic boss of mine, started talking in a very stunning, interesting, compelling way about the educational potential of television. His talk sparked something in Lloyd. Carnegie Corporation was financing studies of how children learn, child development, and so something clicked in his mind of why not use television to teach preschoolers? Because preschoolers were marching to the center of the stage at that time. The government was talking about creating something that became Head Start. Early childhood had become more interesting to educators than it had ever been before. And so he asked me if I'd be willing to take a leave of 3 months from being a producer at 13. I was producing adult shows, talk shows and documentaries, but I was frustrated because you can do one documentary after another and have no effect on the society. And I wanted to see if television could make a real difference. That had been haunting me. So it was a perfect moment for me when Lloyd said, "Would you like to do this?" And the answer is, yes, I would, even though my boss didn't want me to. He wanted me to stay at 13. I took a leave from programming for 3 months and went all over the country talking to educators of preschool children.
You wrote a paper as a result called "The Potential Uses of Television in Preschool Education." And what were the major findings of the paper?
I met with several gifted teachers of gifted children, teachers of preschool children who were in pilot programs that the government was doing as a precursor to Head Start. And if they had said no, this would be terrible. We couldn't have done it. But they were very supportive of the idea. It was all yes, why not? It was so I did a report on their reactions, and then I did described something like Sesame Street, an hour a day, a show that would be something like Sesame Street run by a corporation, a nonprofit corporation, something like the Children's Television Workshop, which is now called Sesame Workshop. And so you could see it on paper, and it was very well received, the paper, by Carnegie and Ford and the government.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact. We'll hear more from Joan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact, among others. The Children's Television Workshop, now called the Sesame Workshop, started the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in 2007 to study the effects of digital technology on childhood literacy. Joan was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1990, and she's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So as a result of this paper, you suggested the launch of the Children's Television Workshop, and you suggested that they start a show, which was at the time not called Sesame Street. Oh. How did you come up with the name Sesame Street?
Well, we were panic-stricken toward the end. We did not have a name. We had decided to put it on a street. We knew it was going to be on an inner-city street. We even knew what street. It was a copy of a street in East Harlem. And
which street was it? Do you know?
I can't remember, but it is something like East 116th Street. I've seen it. It was a street that, by the way, had a mural on one of the buildings, and we had that mural on Sesame Street. So once we knew we were on a street, we had to then find a title. There was even someone wanted to call it 123 Avenue B, and I said, that's too hip and too urban. So finally we got a list of about 60 titles, and we all decided that Sesame Street was the least bad. I don't know why we hated it, because we were hip. It was the late 60s, and so that's why Sesame Street seemed oh so sweet, and nobody wanted sweet, and then we all wanted sweet. I decided sweet was better, and so that was how we got Sesame Street. Partially, the head of our public information was saying, you guys are going to go on the air without any audience.
How did you come up with the idea of having the show be in a city with an urban feel?
Well, we had three extraordinarily gifted producers, John Stone, Sam Gibbon, and Dave Connell, all of whom had worked on Captain Kangaroo previously. John Stone was something of a genius, and everybody knew it at the time. And he's the one that came up with the urban street idea. And we all said, yeah, because our mandate was to reach inner city disadvantaged kids primarily. That is, if we didn't reach them it would, and reached everybody else, it would have been considered a failure.
At what point after it started airing did you say, wow, we have something much bigger here in our hands than we ever expected?
Right away, actually, as soon as it went on the air, the reaction was like swoosh. The press was overwhelmingly favorable, and the audience reaction was overwhelmingly favorable. There were some academic critics, but there were very few of those, and I remember every interview I did with the press, they'd say, how do you feel about your critics? I wanted to say, that is so the least of what we're dealing with here. To me, it was so actually trivial compared to what was really happening out there that it was like, for me, batting away flies. That's not nice to say, but that's how it felt. It was an amazing moment because the women's movement was coming on stream. So the press was not only deeply impressed with Sesame Street, but deeply impressed with the fact that a woman had founded it, which meant they all wanted to talk to me, which was, I kept bringing along Dave Connell to interviews and felt terrible that these geniuses weren't getting the attention they should.
You launched Sesame Street in November 1969.
That's right.
And that was with the help of producers like John Stone, who had been at Captain Kangaroo
yes.
prior. How did you meet Jim Henson, and how did that collaboration begin?
Well, I had seen a reel of his work, and he was so admired within the industry, much less known outside, that it never crossed my mind that we could get him. And John Stone and Dave, and probably Sam too, had worked with him. They said to me, I think we'll talk to Jim Henson, the producer said. And I said, Jim Henson? I mean, to me that was like saying Peter the Apostle. It was amazing. And I said, do you think he would do it? And they said, who knows? But they went and talked to him, and he said he didn't want to do little children's shows, that he would then be categorized as a little children's producer. And that terrified him because he considered himself a family program producer, like The Muppet Show was his ideal show. However, he went home and thought, I have four children. He eventually had five. And it would be something to do for them and their peers. So I knew when we captured Jim Henson, I knew we had it, that we couldn't fail. And then Joe Raposo, the great composer, musician, came to work for us.
A lot of people came to you because they were driven by civil rights. How
yes,
come?
They were interested in children, but they were the idea of expressing the interest in what was going on in America, the civil rights movement, expressing it by trying to reach these children in need was very appealing to this group. Mm. I don't mean that they weren't interested in children because they were interested in civil rights, but the two interests they had came together perfectly.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. You mentioned right from the start that the show was widely accepted. What was harder for you than you thought it would be in getting Sesame Street off the ground?
What was harder? It was so much luck. We had so much luck. The timing could not have been better for raising the money because at that time government and private foundations and then Corporation for Public Broadcasting came on stream and public television as a big entity, they were interested. So the timing was all amazing. In the beginning, we had a hard time convincing some of the representatives of the federal government that Children's Television Workshop, an entity that did not exist and had never produced children's programming, headed by a woman who had never produced a children's program. It was hard convincing them that that was the way to go rather than give the money to a cartoon company. And so we had to kind of battle our way through that. But eventually everybody got aboard, even though a woman at one of the foundations, Ford, said it will never be taken seriously if a woman heads it.
How did you get funding for the show initially? You just talked about this perfect storm of the federal government and private foundations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting coming together.
We couldn't possibly have raised it had it not been for the brilliance of Lloyd Morissette.
Who at the time was the head of the Carnegie Foundation.
He was vice president of Carnegie, but the driver of this particular project. He knew Harold Howe at the Department of, then the Office of Education, but it would be the department now. And that we wanted half the money from the government and got it.
How much money did you raise initially?
We raised $8 million originally. We raised four from the private foundations and CPB and four from the government.
Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Yes.
Now, $8 million in 1969, that's not an insignificant amount of money.
No, it would be like a 40 or 50 today, and people were shocked that that kind of money was being raised for a children's show. When we announced it, it was front page New York Times because it was unbelievable that anyone would spend that kind of money on children. And then the social purposes of the program caught the fancy of the Times and other press.
You mentioned the terrific response that the show got by critics, but there were still some people who were skeptical because you were using television as a medium. What were they saying?
I had made the mistake of saying that maybe we could close the gap between the achievement of poor children, disadvantaged children, and middle class, and that was picked up that within a few months that we certainly weren't closing the gap. And that was absolutely accurate because the middle class was making gains too. So it moved everybody up, but it didn't close any gap. So that was a very unfortunate phrase. So that was criticized.
Now, what was going on in your home life at the time? You didn't have children, so you didn't have to focus on that. But certainly, your life had experienced this sea change, going from a producer of public television, and all of a sudden, this storm comes of Children's Television Workshop and Sesame Street that was much larger than you ever expected. Can you talk me through those days of working on this early on?
Well, I was working all the time. And I think it was hard on my husband. I don't question that. That marriage ended in divorce in 1975, and it had nothing to do with Sesame Street, but I'm sure it was hard on him, all the focus on me. And I remember hating that we'd walk into a room and everyone would ignore him. So I'm sorry about it, but there was nothing I could do about it. And he was interesting. He was very involved in civil rights and was very helpful to me in many ways. He was the first feminist I ever knew. I had never met a woman who was a feminist, even.
Especially the woman at the Ford Foundation.
Right. But he was a feminist, so he was always pressing me to aim at being number one. He was also a very good writer and could help me when I was doing speeches and various things. But eventually he had problems that were not really manageable.
But he was always supportive of what you were doing.
Oh, very.
You are married now to Pete Peterson.
Yes.
And he is the founder of the Blackstone Group.
Yes.
Incidentally, did Pete Peterson play a role in Sesame Street at all?
He did, oddly enough. He was on the board of NET, and NET was the old National Production Center for Public Broadcasting. And I wanted them to administer the workshop for the first year and a half because we didn't know if we wanted to hire lawyers and accountants and all that. What if we failed and had all this staff to fire? So my idea was hire those that we had to have and then ask NET to supply the lawyers, accountants, and administration. And in order to do that, Jack White, who was president, said, you've got to present that to my board, and they've got to approve. And Pete Peterson was on the board, and he asked question after question. He was just fascinated with the idea and came up and said, this is one of the most interesting ideas I've ever heard. Well, naturally, I never forgot him. But we were both married to different people. Our lives went on in separate ways. And then we finally met again when both of us were divorced. It was very romantic.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. The Sesame Workshop created Sesame Street. What did Sesame Street look like in 1969?
It was slower. It was accused of being too fast-paced. But when I look at the early shows, they seem very slow to me. We've changed it a lot now. Elmo was not on early shows and became the superstar when we were about the superstar when we were about 20 years into it. And he now greatly is far more popular than Big Bird. But Big Bird is iconic. I always say he is held up like a crucifix to vampires in the Congress every time they threaten to cut us.
So Sesame Street took off immediately in the United States.
Yes.
When did it start to go global?
Well, the Germans came to me within a year and asked if they could do a co-production for Germany. And their Big Bird was a bear. And Bert and Ernie are a huge sensation in Germany, and have always been. And then the next thing that happened was that Latin America wanted a version, and we ended up doing that in Mexico for all of Latin America except Brazil. And then it began spreading to the Netherlands, Canada, which took the American show but makes Canadian, inserts Canadian films, and they've made it. It's called Sesame Street North. Australia, the English-speaking countries like Australia and Canada wanted it pretty quickly.
Except for England.
Except for England. Just wanted the Muppet pieces, did not want Sesame Street because they did not want Americans teaching English children. Now, of course, we're in Bangladesh. We're in South Africa with an AIDS-positive Muppet. And we're working in Pakistan, and we're starting an Afghanistan version.
And how is that perceived by society in Afghanistan, which tends to be conservative? How do you make adjustments accordingly?
We work with their people and their educators, and they choose what they want to emphasize. They may not want to emphasize letters and numbers. They may want to emphasize the values of mutual respect and understanding, which is a big value in our foreign productions. There's one version in Northern Ireland which emphasizes mutual respect and understanding. We're in Israel and Palestine with different versions. We had hoped to have more unity, but it didn't work out.
And there are characters that remain the same throughout all the countries, like is Oscar the Grouch in all of these?
So Oscar and Big Bird are the same puppeteer. No, they, for example, Israel's Big Bird, or the iconic Muppet, is a porcupine. Tough on the outside, soft on the inside. One Israeli said it should be the reverse.
Your whole life has been focused on children's education through entertainment, yet you don't have any children of your own. How come?
Well, I wanted children, and that just didn't happen. I really was deeply disappointed in my first marriage that didn't happen, but it didn't. I ended up with 5 stepchildren and 9 grandchildren, so children are very much in my life now and have been for many years. Many of the greatest artists, writers, playwrights, book writers of children's television of children's material have never married and don't have children. Maurice Sendak is one that's never married and has no children.
He's Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah. So is the author of Alice in Wonderland, I believe. I don't know. It's a very... Many single men are big artists and writers of children's material. I can't be sure, but I would suggest it's because they still have the child in them for whatever reasons.
Do you feel like you have an inner child or a child within you?
Yes, I do, unfortunately. But the grown-up has conquered. And those are those that keep the child stay creative, and those that have, the grown-up conquers become the executives. Darn. I have this theory that we're all sort of a combination of our fathers and mothers, and that my father triumphed finally in me because much of me was very satisfied with being an executive, of bringing order out of chaos and being the boss. I really loved being the boss. I made up an aphorism that was in Forbes magazine, which is, I've been bossed and I've been boss, and believe me, being boss is better.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of Children's Television Workshop and one of the founders of Sesame Street. Coming up, we'll meet Brian Liu, co-founder of LegalZoom. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Brian Liu, co-founder of LegalZoom, an online legal document service for consumers and small businesses. LegalZoom helps visitors form corporations, file patents, trademark a name, create a last will or living trust without the fees associated with hiring a lawyer. Brian started LegalZoom in 2000 after working as a lawyer at Sullivan & Cromwell in Los Angeles. Brian is a graduate of UC Berkeley, Phi Beta Kappa, and UCLA Law School. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does LegalZoom work?
We came up with this idea because we knew that for a lot of really common legal needs, you really can do this without a lawyer and with just finding the information online. So we created a service where you can go online and you can take care of things on your own. You know, you used to have to go to law school for 3 years to try to figure this stuff out, and it was in a language you didn't understand. And now we simplify it so that everybody has access to that. What we're really trying to do at LegalZoom is democratize law.
I read somewhere that 70% of Americans don't have a will.
Yeah.
And it just made me wonder, like, what percent of people do you think don't have access to the legal system but now do because of online services such as LegalZoom?
The American Bar Association always has done studies like this in the past, and they say that about 50% of the people who have a legal need don't ever get it taken care of. And one of the main reasons they don't is because they just don't think they can afford an attorney. And that's what we're trying to overcome at LegalZoom, mm-hmm. is we're trying to say, hey, look, if you really need help, you should go out and find it instead of doing nothing.
I want to talk about how you came up with the idea for LegalZoom.
Sure.
You were working in the law, and
yeah.
you met your co-founder, Brian Lee, at law school
right.
at UCLA. Was he also practicing law at the time?
Yeah, he was. We were both attorneys, and we were kind of, I'll tell you the truth, we were kind of a little miserable. didn't really like our job. So we were coming up with different business ideas and trying to figure out our escape plan. And I remember seeing this magazine, and they advertised for something called We the People. I remember seeing that they had 6 offices and thinking, wow, if they're doing essentially paralegal-like work and they had 6 offices in Los Angeles, I thought there must be something there. The other thing is, when you're working at the law firm, there's such a disconnect between what you're actually doing and what you thought you would be doing. Like, you know, I got into law school and my parents said, like, you know, well, as soon as you finish law school, I'll finally get that will that mom's been bothering me for years about. Once I did graduate, I had no idea how to do all this stuff. And I think I realized that I could put something together that really blended those needs. And people had a need. And everything from online stock trading to online travel was happening at that time. And we figured, why can't we do something similar for law?
So did you and Brian start working nights and weekends? Or did you quit your jobs first? Talk to me about the mechanics of those early days.
Oh, well, Brian's story will be a little bit different from mine. He actually was the one who decided to quit first. But I still remember the first time we had our first VC meeting with a family friend. This was the first dot-com boom of late 1999, 2000, and we thought we were going to get funded for sure. We thought $5 million funding, no problem. And our very first VC meeting was the day that the NASDAQ crashed like 20% in one day.
VC being venture capital, yep.
Yeah. And we showed up at family friend's office, knocked on the door, and he said, "Brian, what are you doing here?" I said, "Yeah, Uncle, we scheduled this meeting weeks ago." And he said, "Brian, don't you know it's over?" And so we did what any sensible aspiring entrepreneurs would do at that time. We went to Benihana's across the street, you know, had dinner, had a couple of drinks, and said, "Well, what do you think? What should we do?" I mean, we could still ask for our jobs back at this point. Mm-hmm. We could still beg. We decided, you know what? We believe in this so much. And we said, no, we're just going to continue regardless.
You decided to go forward without raising capital initially, just yep. except maybe from friends and family.
That's right.
Why was that a blessing in disguise not to have the capital?
Oh, we raised $333,500. And the $500 was the best because we first started with like, well, you know what? At least $10,000 minimum. And then, okay, maybe $5,000. And it got to the point where we were so desperate, somebody only gave us $500 and we took it. But we were able to really utilize that money in just the best ways that we could, and we didn't have room to waste.
What were signs of early traction with LegalZoom? A sense that, you know what, this is actually resonating with people.
Yeah. First couple weeks, well, you're just waiting for that first real customer. But the sign that I knew that we were onto something was on a Friday night, we were out at dinner. We got 10 orders for a particular document called a living will, a healthcare directive. 10 people throughout the country, I don't know where, but you know, this is Friday night, and they've got nothing better to do than to make living wills on Friday. Wow, we're on to something. That's when I knew.
You brought on board early in the company, in addition to your co-founder, Eddie and Brian, a lawyer by the name of Robert Shapiro,
sure.
Who's famous or maybe infamous for leading the defense team of the O.J. Simpson trial.
That's right.
Why did you think to contact Robert, of all people?
So we knew that we worked at some pretty good law firms and we were pretty good lawyers, but when it comes to something like this, you really need trust. You know, again, people didn't know us, but they certainly knew Robert Shapiro. They knew his reputation. And I think, you know, even after the trial, I think his reputation was very good, very positive. And we just needed somebody like that.
Was there a sense that the trial was so controversial that his joining would bring controversy somehow?
Of course, that was in the back of our mind, but we didn't really think of it that in the same way. I mean, it was really interesting if you saw what was going on with the O.J. Simpson trial when we were in law school at the time, because it was very polarizing. Literally, half the students at the school were just like, you know, when they heard the verdict, it was just like, oh, that was awful. Not half, but a significant percentage, they were clapping. They were like, yes. So we knew that, I mean, there was some controversy around it, but the most important thing was that people believed, I think Robert Shapiro was seen as a very stand-up lawyer, and he's quite good at what he does.
What credibility did he ultimately lend to the initiative in the early days?
Fantastic, I mean, an incredible amount. I don't think Brian and I would have immediately or that quickly quit our jobs and left unless if we knew that Robert Shapiro was on board. I mean, he really was one of the original founders. And when we launched, we had such a great publicity surrounding it, and it really added something to our own self-esteem as well.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Brian Liu, co-founder of LegalZoom, a company that helps consumers and small businesses prepare their own legal documents online. LegalZoom aims to save people time and money and make the legal process more accessible to consumers and small businesses who otherwise might not have bothered with such documentation as a living will or a prenup agreement. You have faced a lot of legal hurdles from the bar associations mm-hmm. across, you know, several states, stating that you are there's unauthorized practice of law. Mm-hmm. So one way to address that has been to add legal advice to LegalZoom
right.
By connecting visitors to lawyers around the country.
That's correct.
Can you describe that more?
Sure. I mean, we always knew that this would be something potentially that some of the state bar associations wouldn't be happy with. But again, we were always pretty clear in our heads that we weren't really competition against attorneys. We weren't, quote, stealing business away from them. This is really about how do you increase access? How do you get more people the legal help that they need? So, you know, our early stage, our phase one, I'd say, or stage one, was really about utilizing technology and creating self-help documents so that people can get, you know, fairly standard documents. And by the way, these same documents have been available for decades, either online where you can download it, and for centuries through books. Now, what we're doing is combining the actual help from real attorneys, licensed attorneys, and combining that with the document automation platform that we have and creating a more full service. And that's really what we always imagined.
You ultimately did raise venture capital from firms like Kleiner Perkins and Institutional Venture Partners and
yep.
Polaris.
Right.
Can you talk to me about some of those meetings?
They were tense, I'll tell you. They were very tense meetings. You worked so hard to get to that point.
What was tense about those meetings in particular?
Without getting into all the details, there was a lot of argument over whether we should take these additional fundraising rounds. And mm-hmm. and one person said no, and then we had to figure out a way to actually make it happen, even though mm-hmm. they technically had a veto right. So we looked around until there was a structure that kind of circumvented that. And it required a little bit of a push.
The appeal to these VCs was that you were disrupting an industry. What was it about LegalZoom in 2006 or 2007, do you think, that didn't appeal to them in 2000, aside from the macro economy improving, although this is before 2008?
Frankly, they couldn't envision something in the business of law working. They didn't see how it could scale. Mm-hmm. And it's very different now. I mean, I think at last time I looked, there were over 600 startup legal companies in different aspects of the legal space, of course, but over 600 on Angel's List.
It's striking how, you know, the word lawyer makes you want to yawn
yep.
a little bit, yet they're dealing with the most, like, base human needs and emotions, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, dealing with divorce forms and prenuptial agreements and privacy matters. I mean, what have you learned about just behavior of people? Do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
This might be, you know, the technical business and what we do might be words on paper, but that's not really what we're doing. We're really helping people in times of need. I'll give you one example. One time, a long time ago when we were starting out, we actually did an investor pitch with somebody who had a terminal disease, and she was going through the living will process. We did it, you know, kind of like walked her through it in real time and actually saw it. And I mean, it's just incredibly, incredibly emotional. Again, the legal part of the legal documents, that's not hard. The decisions that people make in terms of, you know, whether they want to be kept on life support, who their property goes to, those aren't legal questions. Those are personal questions.
What are other examples?
There's this Indian restaurant that I go to all the time. And one day I was talking to the I don't know how I got started. I was talking to the owner, and I realized that he had just incorporated on LegalZoom, his restaurant business. And you know, we started talking about everything that was related to how he got this restaurant. He was from Bangladesh, and he came over there with his brother, and they basically did everything they could to put their money into this one restaurant, this business, and now they have two restaurants. And just hearing the story, which is that, you know, that great immigrant and that great American dream story, that's what's really amazing, because behind every business there is a tremendous story.
You have helped to launch a company called Zenify,
right?
Which is a beverage company, a so-called functional beverage. What is a functional beverage?
It's a drink that, aside from just being a refreshing drink that quenches thirst, it has a function. And this particular function for Zenify is it's all about natural stress relief.
What are the chemicals in it that cause the stress relief mechanism?
It's got the same antioxidants as you find in green tea, but without the caffeine.
What's L-theanine is one of the ingredients?
That's right.
Is that the chemical that's in green tea, but without the caffeine in this
drink?
That's
exactly it. That's the antioxidant that you'll find in green tea.
And GABA and glycine is?
It's from chamomile.
Now, you seem like an active person yourself, like a somebody who would drink Zenify. Like, you exercise a lot.
Sure.
And what kind of exercise do you do?
I'm a big surfer. That's my favorite thing. But I also will train at the Freddie Roach's Wild Card Boxing Gym. It's a boxing club. It's just such focused intensity for a short period of time that it focuses my mind, but it's also soothing and meditative at the same time.
Do you meditate?
I don't meditate, but I do on the surfboard. when I'm out in the ocean on the weekends, usually by myself, and it's just so beautiful out there, it's like meditation.
Why is it that you like surfing so much, would you say?
I think it's about there's nothing like that feeling of being one with nature and being one with the wave. And I can yell, go on, but then I'll just sound like a surfer dude.
How did you get interested in surfing? You're from Taiwan and Seattle.
Yeah, I think it must have happened when I was young visiting Hawaii one day. And I don't know what happened. I just got hooked. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew I wanted to live in LA just because I wanted to be close to the ocean.
What do your parents do?
My dad was, he's in the shipping business. So he was a captain. He was one of the youngest captains of this particular fleet of merchant ships. And then he moved our family to Taiwan because he didn't want to always be away from the family because he was, you know, months at a time out, you know, on the ships. So he found a desk job. And we actually came from Taiwan to the U.S. on one of those boats. It took 30 days to get here.
Yes, I mean, I've read a lot about being out at sea, these captains of these, you know, cargo ships. And
right.
What a lonely existence.
Yeah, especially back then. I mean, those ships were a lot smaller and you were out for a long, long time. But at some point in time, he decided to start on his own and he got this little office. And I remember one thing he told me is that, you know, there were four desks there, and he was the only person there. And I asked him, well, what about all these other desks? What about all the furniture? And he said, you know, I bought all those desks. I bought, at that time, typewriters, no computers. He bought the office equipment, didn't rent them, didn't lease them, because he said, you know, because I'm going to fill those up soon.
Hmm. And he started another shipping company? Or?
Yeah, it was just an agency.
What was he shipping?
Basically, it was containers, anything that's exported from the U.S. over to Asia. He was one of the first people to charter a whole boat. This was such a long time ago, but we just started doing trade with China at that time. So he was one of the first people to actually do trades with China. I still remember because he was so early, we got invited to China once when we were really young, and we met like all these really big, big, you know, Communist Party leaders, even Mao Zedong's like granddaughter or daughter or something. It was really, really pretty crazy.
Did you grow up speaking Chinese in your home?
I did.
What was it like for you growing up in Seattle, having had the first half decade of your life in Taiwan? Or were you too young to notice any
difference? I was too young, I think. But I met one of my great friends, best friends, Randy, who was my next door neighbor, we started our very first business together.
What was the business?
We made these pins. We made these buttons. And it was during the height of the Michael Jackson craze. And we made these pins that says, I do not heart Michael Jackson. And we would go to these rock concerts, you know, we'd go to like, you know, these heavy metal rock concerts and start selling these pins over there. It was really, that was really fun.
So your first business was selling I don't love Michael Jackson pins.
Right.
Did you have a sense as you were growing up that you wanted to start your own businesses? I mean, also, you know, upon seeing your father, or
I think somewhere in the back of my mind that was always there, because even when I went to law school, one of my very best friends, Brian Lee, who I started LegalZoom with, we met the first day of law school. And we kind of, you know, I think we connected because I looked at him and he looked at me and he said, what are you doing here in law school? And I said, well, I don't know. What are you doing?
Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Brian Liu, co-founder of LegalZoom. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.